property officer, and the director of the general services. The subject is relocating the state property program to Anchorage, in which there seems to be a difference of opinion, and if there is, I'll let you speak to yourself. Mr. Bradley?
Yes, sir.
Problem that we would face on the, probably in a big conference. Would you identify yourself, sir?
Yes, sir. Richard C. Bradley, Director, Division of General Services and Supply Department of Administration.
Mr. Bradley, we have a memo of you on May 19th to Earl Prince, manager of the Property Control Division of General Services, etc. And it generally says, per our past discussions and my review, people, state and federal property programs would be enhanced by combining the two in a single Anchorage location. And considering goes on, based upon the proceeding, I want to effect relocation on or about July 15th, 1976. This will be for all positions now operating in general. Would you like to comment on it, sir?
Well, yes, I reviewed the state property program and feel that it ties in very well with our federal surplus property program. One, the federal property program is now housed in Anchorage, and the state program here in June. And in Anchorage, we do have a warehouse and yard facility, which we have nothing here. I feel that this is the most expedient way and best way administratively to coordinate both programs. One, in other words, would enhance the other.
Did you think to notify anybody in the finance committees as to the possible shortfall of funds to move these people and the differences in the pay areas?
No, sir.
How did you expect to pay for it?
Well, I was looking at it more in terms of savings to the state taxpayer.
But you have to pay the people to work.
That's true, but our service to state agencies and to the recipients for federal property would be guaranteed better service. I'd be a better service. I'm sure we could figure a way to take care of the minimal cost of making the relocation. In the first place, we're paying approximately $1.30 per square foot for office space here in Juneau, whereas in Anchorage, we're not going to be obligated to pay for any space there. Be housing this in an existing office facility that we have in a warehouse.
Mr. Prince, would you like to identify yourself, sir?
Yes, Earl Prince, State Property Officer, Division of General Services and Supply.
According to your memo, back to Mr. Bradley, you have mentioned that on two previous occasions that he had asked your opinion on moving the property control section to Anchorage, and think about this, since it would not come about immediately. You said you gave him his thoughts at that time, but you were not aware that he was waiting for a written memorandum. So that sets the background. Now, perhaps you could tell us what your views are on the proposed relocation.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I feel like I would like to kind of break the state property program into two sections. We have state property accounting, which we're responsible for, and guide direct inventory of all state property. And then we have the surplus, state surplus program, which we transfer all property from one department to another and sell, which this year has already exceeded over $500,000 in sales, and anything from typewriters to highway speed. The surplus ties into the property accounting only in the that it, everything you dispose of, unless one department has to come off of that property, department's inventory, right? In property accounting, we, discussed with Dick here on the, that I was opposed, mostly is because, under statute 4417-06-030, each executive officer of each department is responsible for the custody of his property. And that works in conjunction with our 3705-160, that would guide and direct the inventory. We require each department to have a property control officer. And therefore, divisions cannot come in and take property, just dispose of property at their will, because your inventory records couldn't keep straight. All property is put on or taken off at headquarters of each department, which is human with the exception of military affairs. And the largest percentage of their property is federal property. I was afraid that we have to communicate with the department so much that we would be so far removed. And, we have a computer in Anchorage that's not as large as the one in Juneau, and it could be our program could be reprogrammed and put on a computer in Anchorage. But, if a piece of property, say, was brought to Anchorage, we would have to come down to the fiscal section of Juneau. They would have to put it on a receiving report, send it up to us. We'd put it on a computer. We'd have to have a transaction report, send it back to Juneau. And same way with the inventory runs. And I felt that this would, plus that property control was probably one of the hardest things to control in departments. Everybody likes to spend everything, but they don't care about controlling it after they get it. They like to buy it when the guy's appropriating the money, but trying to keep it on. So we have to work with the departments, I felt, that we would be pretty far removed from them in Anchorage. And the only other thing I thought is in talking with Tom Lane that we would have to be charged for space. Federal has got surplus property program is controlled by HEW out of Seattle, and they have quite stringent regulations that we would still have to be accountable. We still have to maintain a property program for the state as well as for the federal government.
What about the items? Is there any much more items in the Anchorage area than there is in the southeast?
Well, no, there's more. Right in the Anchorage area as a whole, there's approximately 9,000 items less than there is in Juneau. If you want to break it down into districts, the western and northern has, central is the Anchorage area, has almost the same amount as Juneau, but that includes everything from Valdez, they're out on the loop and chain, but it still removes quite a bit from Anchorage.
Is Mr. Bradley your superior?
Yes, he is.
Would you like to reply, Mr. Bradley?
Mr. Chairman. In looking at these recaps, I had property quantities recapped by location or geographic section, southeastern, western, northern, and central Alaska. And in southeastern, we have a total of $155 million in accountable property. In the other three locations or sections, we have well over 250,000. And plus the fact, of course, we're taking into consideration $70 million in southeastern being for the ferries alone. So if we reduce that, we've got about 80 to 90% of the accountable property, the bulk of the accountable property, in the other areas of the state. I think what Earl has spoken to here in his reply to my memorandum is strictly the Anchorage area. We're not looking at the Anchorage area. We're looking at that all of the areas outside of southeastern.
I thought he just mentioned the chain in that.
Beg your pardon?
I thought he just mentioned the chain. What what difference would it make if you had a, if you had a warehouse in Anchorage and your surplus property was in Alaska? That wouldn't help you anyway.
No, we're talking, I'm talking about inventory control. This is where we actually go out and take physical inventories.
Could you confer with Mr. Prince before you made a determination to move the department, or did you just ask him?
Yes, I did confer with him. Discuss it.
You did discuss it with him?
Yes. Two different cases.
Did you ask him for his ideas on it?
Yes, I did.
Do you have anything to say, Mr. Prayer?
Well, Mr. Chairman, what we're talking about here, of course, is a management decision being made in the department. Sometimes management decisions aren't the most popular thing. Sometimes they work adversely in the minds of some people. But in the overall, we make them with the intention of improving the service that our department provides to the public. Thought behind this suggested move, something that wasn't come about lightly, it's been considered for some time. And then the overall, we feel that we'll be able to provide a better service in the poverty control program.
In other words, what you're saying is that the administration's business is their own and has nothing to do with the legislature. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chairman, I think there are times when administrators have to make decisions consult the legislature about. They are their businesses to make decisions. In this case, it's a management decision being made in the department.
Are there any questions from any of them?
What would be the cost?
Of course, we don't know yet how many people from Anchorage want to move with the program. Apparently, there will be one, at least tentative, which means that we would have to do the hiring of the remaining three if the one gets decided to go in Anchorage. So as far as moving costs, it would be none. We'd have whatever the cost would be for a couple desks and a typewriter and those type of things.
The difference in the amount of money you pay the personnel, correct, Mr. Bradley? Are we on the same again?
Same salary schedule.
They have the same salary schedule? I thought that they went up. Well, then we don't have anything to worry about in that score. Excuse me, Mr. Bradley.
My only question, Mr. Chairman, was that for any moving costs, wouldn't that have to be approved by the legislature? Would we need to appropriate the funds for purchase, or do you do it out of changes in the budget that you give you?
Well, as I pointed out earlier, we'll have a cost, one cost saving would be the difference in the cost for office space.
And that could apply
or be justified as part of the moving cost.
You'd make a transfer then to your
office? To be very truthful, I don't know exactly how we would do that. I would assume that would be one of the cost savings that could be applied. Of course, we're talking about a one-time cost as far as moving people, but the ongoing cost for the savings in square footage would continue.
Would you recognize the letter of intent, Mr. Freer, in the budget document in the state property office that this move is not to take place?
This is prospective.
If it was the intent of the legislature that this was not to be done, what would be your reaction?
Consider it most carefully.
Okay. No other questions from the convening? Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate your courtesy and convenience and promptness in coming.
Mr. Warwick would have been here this morning. Meeting his family on a return from Hawaii and
very good. Very fine. Thank you. Thank you. would absolutely, he's the guy that's in charge of the division, he explains to him chapter and verse why he shouldn't do it, then he shouldn't do it. Maybe you'll have to take a little closer look at it. Because I suppose that one poor guy is, has his supervisors. Did you ask something, Stuart?
I was asked to be here, sir.
This is in regard to tuition rates, House Bill 899.
Oh, yes.
I had a committee substitute drawn up in regard to a request made by Mr. Leonard from Sean Jackson. Any difference of opinion in the way it should be wrapped up, and I thought that we should go along with Mr. Hall's recommendations.
Chairman, members of the committee, one of the principal reasons why the state and the is in court over a question of whether the present program is constitutional has a large measure to do with the fact that the statute as presently drafted involves the state very deeply in the management of the private institutions in terms of oversight, management, oversight and surveillance of their activities. Was the opinion of our office and also the Attorney General's office that, in fact, the as administered, the program really wasn't a student aid program. It was a program which directly benefited the institution itself in violation of our state constitution, aside from any potential federal constitutional questions. What the proposed Senate committee substitute does is to convert the program into a direct student aid program. The Attorney General's office is of the view that the constitutional amendment which you adopted placed before the voters the other day, in effect, ratifies the so-called child benefit theory that was enunciated by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Everson case back in 1947, and which our Supreme Court had rejected in Matthews against Quinton. Now, if that is so, and I will take their word for it, that's what it does, because they drafted the amendments that were finally adopted by the Senate, then it would be necessary, it seems to me, to revise the statutes to provide that the grant itself go directly to the student, and that he be responsible for managing it and seeing to it that by stating under oath that he will apply it to his tuition, and eliminate from the statute those provisions, and there are a number of them that require stipulate precisely how the money is to be used, what it may not be used for, and that certain proportions of the institutional income have to come from certain sources in order to qualify for the tuition grants and so forth. The various repealers, however, do not eliminate the two important restrictions. Number one, that the money not be used for sectarian or political purposes. It was that particular clause that saved the tuition grant program in Kansas and Maryland and was upheld by the court on the basis of that statement, and that is retained. And also it retains that the provision that the grants must be used at accredited college, private colleges or universities in Alaska. And it retains the provision that if a student is receiving both a scholarship loan and a tuition grant, the no part of his scholarship loan may be forgiven, because mathematically as it works out, the amount of grant that he gets is roughly the same as the 40% forgiveness feature of the scholarship loan. Other than that, the references to institutional management and control are repealed, and the provision that relates to the refereeing of consortium agreements and disputes that may arise under them are shifted over to that portion of the college and university chapter in Title 14 that relate to the Post-Secondary Education Commission. It makes no substantive change in the law whatsoever, other than to say, as 899 did when it passed out of the House, that all parties to the consortium agreements must abide by them, and not just the private colleges and university. That the staff has long felt was an unfortunate choice of language back in 72, which has impeded the operation of those agreements and made them very one-sided. And we think that the change that is proposed in that aspect.
Are you convinced all that now, Stuart, and does your committee substitute take care of the job?
It is our opinion, Mr. Chairman, that it will resolve these constitutional problems. It will tend to short-circuit the litigation, at least we hope so. It will also, Sheldon Jackson, attorneys believe, help release them from the $40,000 bond, which
you have that
posed on.
Do you have a draft of that?
I have a draft. Essentially substitute, yes.
Okay.
Where is it?
Is that what we got?
In the folders.
Where's the original bill?
What's that?
Where's the original?
It's on your desk.
I got a question.
Yeah, right. On my desk? Here.
Page 3, line 23. I can't make any sense out of that sentence. The tuition grant paid to a part-time student may an amount that would result in a student paying less tuition.
See, that may be a typo.
I don't think it is. May what? May not or may be?
Page 3, what?
Line 23.
Oh. Yeah, May not be in an amount. I'll catch that.
May not
be in
an.
Gosh, sometimes our fine machines do go astray.
I'd like to read that.
I will make that typographical correction if someone has the original bill.
Okay.
House Bill 842. That's about as strong as you can get it, I guess. I have a committee substitute that was drawn up by the administration. That's it. It adds the words there on line 14. It says, the agreement shall provide for an area differential in pay between employees residing inside and outside the state to reflect the difference in the cost of living for those employees. That's the new language. Senate Committee substitute.
And you would keep that language or eliminate the language starting on 920?
Section 1 of this act may not be implemented by collective bargaining, which results in an agreement which reduces the wages of fringe benefits received on the effective date of this act by employees residing inside and outside the state. Ready?
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
The language is different.
Well,
that's what.
Oh, I see. All right. Section 2 here says, Section 1 of this act may not be implemented by collective bargaining, which results in an agreement which reduces the wages and fringe benefits received on the effective date of this act by employees residing inside and outside the state. In other words, they can't automatically reduce the outside people's wages by 25%.
So what they'll do is increase the wages.
They can't increase
the state,
it either. Well,
if you put in the first language, they do it, don't they?
Yeah.
Requires for wage differential.
Inside and outside both.
Yeah.
Is there a motion?
Yeah.
I mean, we need that to go with individual recognition.
Pass. How many no rec? How many do not pass?
I'll put no rec.
I'm
going to put no rec. And I know how Chancey feels when boys votes. How many do pass? How many no rec? How many do not pass?
Reason gets confused on voice vote. Some people vote on both sides. I read that yesterday. That's
I wasn't paying attention.
Department.